This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. The program is called Main Street because, well, we're the Main Street in North Dakota. And just like the Main Streets in every town across the state, we meet each other, we share our news and opinions, we do our business, we gather there on a Main Street. And today, we're going to talk about something that is on our minds generally quite a bit. We talk about food quite a lot as a topic of conversation, along with the weather. And of course, the weather is poised to return and make us hunker down one more time, but it is winter. So on to what we're going to talk about today. If we are what we eat, it's probably a good idea to know as much as we can about what it is we're eating. Denise Minger is somewhat relentless in her search for nutrition knowledge. She blogs about her eating habits, but more than that, she is the type of person who studies the studies done on food, and she is not shy about saying if she disagrees. She's the author of the new book, Death by Food Pyramid: How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. Main Street's Ashley Thornburg visited with Denise about what led her down the path to nutrition writing.
Denise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Your book, Death by Food Pyramid: How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. Now, you're an English major who writes a book. That one, I think I get. But an English major who basically is going after statistical analyses, and specific in this case to nutrition, that one's a little bit of a harder sell. How did you get along this path?
Well, I pretty much entered the nutrition scene in an attempt to save my own health. And so initially, my whole journey kind of started when I was 7 years old, and I went vegetarian at that time by my own choice. My parents thought it was just a phase, but what happened is I almost choked on a piece of steak, and I became really phobic of anything with a meat texture. So I went vegetarian at that point, and when I was 11, I was then diagnosed with a wheat allergy. And so at that point, I couldn't eat a whole lot of things in terms of what common foods were, because so many things have wheat in them. And a few years later, I was diagnosed with a soy allergy and a dairy allergy. And at that point, I was like, well, there's really nothing I can eat that normal people are consuming right now. And so I had to start learning about nutrition, learning how to read food labels, just really diving into the world of food. And it was at that point that I started experimenting with my own diet, just because I had been very sick as a child. I was never in great health. And I went raw vegan for a year. And the raw vegan diet is basically nothing that has been cooked, nothing that's been heated. It's just raw fruits, vegetables, nuts, and seeds. And so I went a year on this diet after reading about it on the internet. And at the time, things I had heard about this diet on the internet seemed so glowing and perfect that I had convinced myself it must be a really great way to eat. And so this was my first adventure into trusting uncredible resources, which became a theme later in my life, something that I'm very passionate about targeting and tackling. But at the time, I was very young. I was 16 years old, and I embarked on this very unbalanced eating program. And after a year, I had 16 cavities in my teeth. My hair was falling out, and I weighed like 95 pounds, and I was really in very poor shape. And so that was my first introduction into this big problem we have just in the general public as we're listening for diet advice and trying to find people to trust, which is that there's a lot of people out there who are giving bad information about what kinds of foods we should be consuming, about what the optimal diet for humankind is, so on and so forth. And so as part of my own recovery process, I decided, well, I really don't know who to trust at this point. So I started doing my own research and reading scientific journal articles and just learning as much as I could about biochemistry, about how the human body works, about nutrient interactions. And frankly, I'm kind of a nerd, so I found that kind of thing fascinating. And I ended up just pursuing it as a hobby for a very long time. And I started a blog kind of outlining some of my findings on various topics related to health and nutrition. And eventually from that, it segued into a book contract. Again, on the nutrition, the topic of nutrition. So, yeah, I started out as an English major, and I'm kind of glad I got to put my love for words into use. But at the same time, nutrition has been a hobby of mine for a really long time, and I'm really excited to be able to convey my findings to the public.
I've seen you described as intense, and a self-starter, self-learner. One thing, you know, usually people who are this interested in a subject like nutrition, and particularly with a backstory as personal as yours is, go on to study this in some kind of formal way. Why are you sticking with it mostly as something that you do as an educated hobby?
That's a very good question. And honestly, you know, I've toyed with the idea of going back to school, especially because both of my parents work in higher education and tend to really promote that idea. And although I have nothing negative to say about people who go through formal degree training to get, you know, an education in health, at the same time, the kind of information that most universities are putting out is very heavily biased, and it's essentially a compilation of the accrued wisdom from the U.S. Department of Agriculture and other organizations that actually have an agenda to push. And so the idea of going to school to get training for something like that is less appealing to me than actually going straight to primary sources and actually just reading the literature myself, rather than having it filtered to me through teachers and through other people who have perhaps been force-fed information that isn't completely accurate. So the whole idea of going back to school for something like this as well, a big, I guess, question mark I have is whether or not that would actually be a positive in the long term, or whether it would actually just create more bias and dogma to sort through.
The food writing that you do, or nutrition writing, I should call it, mm-hmm. How much research would you say that you do before you write, either on your blog or in some of your published work?
A lot. For me, typically writing a blog post is a 2 to 3 month process, which is why my blog, I love blogging, but I post, only a handful of times per year, which I feel kind of bad about as a blogger. But at the same time, there's so much learning that goes into any subject related to nutrition. And the funny thing is, as soon as you start to research any topic within that umbrella, you notice that you kind of have to learn everything that's surrounding it as well. Like, you need the context, and so that leads to more research needs. And at the same time, the research process usually unveils the fact that there's a lot of differing opinions out there, and that there's rarely a consensus about almost anything within nutrition. So it's usually a process of having to pursue ideas that I think might be right, and then also pursue counter arguments against them to see whether I can disprove those arguments. And so it's just this big process of trying to sort through a lot of contradictory information and settle on what seems to be the strongest truth at that point in time. So it definitely takes quite a few hours of research before I write anything. And my book itself took about 3 years. And that was pretty nonstop in terms of research. So there's a lot that goes into it.
Yeah, I read on your blog that you pretty much gave up things like birthdays and eatings.
Yeah, it was pretty much just a whirlwind of typing on the computer and reading.
With your focus being so much on disproving, or at the very least challenging, the conclusion of other research that's out there, your first real success in this was going after what's called the China study, which is, I don't want to say the Bible, but something that's very much revered by people who promote a vegetarian and a vegan lifestyle. Tell me briefly, because of course this is a large project, but tell me about going after that project.
Yeah, so the China study, there's actually two things that the China study can refer to. And one is a book written by a guy named T. Colin Campbell, who's professor emeritus at Cornell. He just has this incredible laundry list of credentials and experience. And he produced this book in 2005, co-wrote it with his son. And the book's title actually comes from a study called the China study. And this was a giant, giant observational study conducted in rural China, mostly throughout the 1980s. And what happened was researchers went into 65 counties within China, specifically seeking out places where people ate the same diet from birth until death. And they surveyed inhabitants of all these different counties, and just on things like food consumption. They documented every variable, like every kind of vegetable and fruits and what kind of grains they're eating, how much meat and dairy and eggs they're eating, and eventually correlated those things with mortality outcomes. So they took the foods people are eating as well as their lifestyle variables and then tried to see how those lined up or related to the way people were dying. And so according to the book, The China Study, what this project found was that in China, any increase of animal food consumption, especially animal protein consumption, was causing chronic diseases like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, so on and so forth. And so when I read this book, you know, I had my own experience as a vegan and being a vegetarian for a very long time. But at the point where this book started becoming very popular, I had actually had to return to animal foods to restore my own health after my raw vegan experience. So this was a very interesting book to me because it seemed to fly in the face of my own experiences and my own body. And so what I did was I tracked down the original data of the study, which was published in this 900-page monograph. It was nothing but correlations and numbers after numbers after numbers. And again, I'm kind of a nerd, so I love looking at stuff like that and kind of trying to dissect it. So at this time, I just started up a little blog that didn't have much of a following at all. And I decided, you know, I'm just going to prune through this original data, and I'm going to see if it matches up with this author, with what he's saying it says. And so I spent about 2 or 3 months, again, just kind of poring over this information, this data, crunching my own numbers, running some stats on it. And what I found was that the author of this book had really approached the data with a strong bias. And his own background in research, this is my opinion, or what I can kind of deduce from the situation, I think he approached the data with the intention of finding out that animal foods were harmful and that a near-vegan diet was optimal for humankind. And so in a study that's large, it's very easy to find what you're looking for if you just kind of block out everything else from your field of vision. And I think that's a big problem in many forms of research, many fields. But anyway, so what I found was that rather than what he was claiming about this set of data, the findings were actually very different. And so I published a critique on my blog, and it was giant. It was ginormous. It just took forever to write. It took a very long time to complete. And it was mostly just, you know, to put this thing out on the internet. If anyone is interested, they could read it. And I really didn't expect it to get much of a response. But my main arguments were that the way he had, cherry-picked, basically, data from the study that was conducted was very misleading, and it wasn't actually showing that animal foods were harmful. In fact, there were some things I found, like people who were eating more animal products were actually getting less heart disease within China, which was a very surprising finding. So I just published basically my critique of his work, and it happened to go viral thanks to a few people who are also bloggers who came across my critique and decided to just bullhorn it all over the internet. So my blog went from having about 5 to 10 readers to having, I think, about 20,000 visits in one day, which was just flabbergasting.
To a layperson like myself, I can see some truth in a lot of the arguments that he was made oversimplifying here, which I'm sure you love. Something like, you know, we don't have the same anatomy. We're not built the same way as a cheetah. Why should humans eat like that? Doesn't it make sense that the farther we get from natural, the more problems could arise?
Right. I think there's two ways to look at that. Definitely the more that we move away from foods that are existing as we see them in nature, the more we process things, the more we add chemicals and preservatives and additives to them. That definitely has a strong link with our declining health outcomes. And, you know, if you look at what people ate just 200 years ago, many of them would not recognize 90% of what we have in our grocery stores today, because so much of what we have right now is completely man-made. But going back to that anatomy issue, I think that that's an argument that's often used to promote veganism or in vegetarianism, and it makes a lot of sense on the surface. Like, if you look at a human, we don't have massive claws. We can't, rip into an animal with our teeth and tear it into pieces and, you know, eat it like a carnivore would. And so I think a lot of people see that very basic argument, and they think, well, yeah, we must just be herbivores. But the problem with that is if you look at, say, other primates like chimpanzees and gorillas and our closest genetic relatives, you can actually see that over the last 2 million years, humans' digestive anatomy has changed in a very big way. And what has happened is our colons, which is where you process these very fibrous plant foods, things like leaves and tough fruits and that sort of thing, our colons have actually shrunk. And proportionately, our small intestines are longer. So if you look at the insides of humans versus other primates, we have a very distinct difference between them. And anthropologists who study this kind of thing, their best theory at this point is that humans became adapted to eating much denser foods than these other primates. And what happened was we started cooking our food, we started eating more meat and more animal products that don't require digestion in the colon. They mostly get digested in the small intestine. And so as a result, our digestive anatomy has changed throughout the last millennia, millions of years, about 2 million years. And so at this point, we're pretty square in the omnivore territory. And, people can survive on a very wide range of diets, ranging from very few animal products to a larger quantity. And I think the argument that we must be anatomical herbivores is, if you look closely at it, it just has a lot of holes in it.
And you go into that a little bit more in your own book. Again, the title of that, Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. Who is the intended audience of this book?
Everybody. I really want this to be a book that can reach the general public. And I try to write in a way that will be accessible to people who don't have a strong science background, people who are just kind of confused about what to believe, as well as to people who are more seasoned in the nutrition field who've been studying things for a longer period of time. And basically the book's goal is just to empower people to be critical thinkers and to help them sort through this massive information we have swirling around us about what kinds of foods we should be eating. Because no matter what, every person on this planet has to eat food. And right now, I think we're in a state of extreme confusion, especially in the West, where we have this diet culture that tells us something different every single day.
That is writer and food activist Denise Menger. She's written Death by Food Pyramid, How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. When we come back, Ashley and Denise will discuss how political influence has affected dietary advice.
One of the sections of
It's a night of jazz on Prairie Public. Following the rebroadcast of Main Street, we kick it off with Friday Night Swing with Lloyd Anderson. Then at 9 Central, it's Riverwalk Jazz. And at 10, Bob Studebaker hosts as we present both classic jazz from the legends of American music and new jazz from emerging artists. At 11, it's The Jazz Junket with Ryan Schweitzer, followed at midnight by Jim Wilkie's Jazz After Hours. That's all right here, statewide, on Prairie Public.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. In the background, that's Victor Wooten with his CD, Palmistry. Little jazz in the afternoon. Well, we're going to get back to our discussion between Ashley Thornburg and Denise Menger. Denise is a writer and food activist. And when we left, they were getting to the intersection of politics and nutrition.
One of the sections of the book starts by talking about politics and moneyed interest. Talk about the role that played. To narrow it down, let's talk specifically the role that they played before we got the food guide pyramid as it previously existed.
Sure. So to understand this issue, it kind of helps to look at the USDA, because the USDA is the dispenser of the food guides that we get in America. And it's the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And so right away, we know that their interest is really promoting agricultural interests. And back when the USDA was first brought into the world, which is, I think, 1865, it was by Abe Lincoln. He signed it into existence. At that time, Americans were dying mostly of things like infection and starvation, malnutrition, things that were related to eating not enough food or not enough variety of food. And so back at this time, for the USDA to promote mass consumption of all of its agricultural products was actually a boon for human health. And it wasn't until World War II where our disease pattern started shifting. And suddenly we had better medical care, we had more sanitation, so things like those infectious diseases were dropping dramatically. And for the first time in history, people were dying quite rapidly of heart disease, and cancer was becoming an issue. And even diabetes, obesity started popping up, just things that we had really never seen before, at least not in mass quantity. And so at that time, the USDA's mission to support farmers and agricultural interests started becoming kind of a catch-22, because in order to promote these agricultural products, which were largely things like flour and sugar and things that aren't necessarily great for human health, in order to promote those things and also tell people what to be eating, it was just kind of a mission that was trapped to begin with. So a big issue with when food guides started getting developed was that no food industry wanted to be the bad guy. And as soon as any official within the government started saying, okay, we have to reduce fat, or we have to reduce meat, or we have to reduce, high-fat dairy intake, those food industries would basically throw up their arms and start protesting. And as giant industries, they had quite a bit of power to bully the federal officials into changing their opinion and changing their public advice. So back in 1977, we could really see this in broad daylight, basically. What was going on was there was a governor named Senator McGovern, and he was in charge of a committee that had, originally when it was conceived, was just about solving hunger in America. But over the years, it turned to change its focus on actually fixing chronic disease within America through nutrition and through changing Americans' diet. So what happened was they were going to release this set of recommendations that would basically say eat less meat, eat less dairy, especially red meat and high-fat dairy, eat more whole grains, eat less refined grains, eat less sugar, and eat less salt. And what happened was all of these industries that were being targeted by those eat less recommendations ended up literally bullying the officials into changing the wording on these documents and just completely warping the original message. And so the only thing that ended up sticking was eat less fat kind of overall. But again, it became very vaguely worded because the industries didn't want to lose money. And so this is a theme that has repeated itself over and over and over throughout the course of history in our dietary guidelines, because the USDA is so tightly webbed with these food industries that it's very hard for it to dispense objective information at this point.
And then your book goes on to talk about, what goes into a science study, and then you also dissect a couple of the more popular diets out there. But basically, in your book, you're not necessarily advocating one diet over another, but more so just asking people to question what it is they read. Do you hope that someone out there goes after your work the way that you go after other published works?
No, I would love it. Actually, I my whole commitment with this whole nutrition thing is to just find the truth. And I think a big issue within this community is that many people get attached to their own ideas, and there's a lot of ego involvement, and it just becomes very hard to be objective about what you're looking at, because we're all approaching the subject with our own preconceived notions. So if anyone sees me doing that, and if I'm approaching something with my own bias, or if there's something in my book that is not completely accurate, I really hope that someone will step up and challenge that, because my whole goal is just to continually improve and continually expand my own understanding and just move closer and closer to some understanding of the truth. So I think the more that we challenge each other, hopefully in very respectful ways, but challenge each other's ideas and our information, the more that happens, the more we'll be able to move forward. So, yeah, if anyone wants to do that to me, I would actually be very grateful.
All right. Denise Minger is the author of Death by Food Pyramid: How Shoddy Science, Sketchy Politics, and Shady Special Interests Have Ruined Our Health. You can get a copy of the book on Amazon, and there is also a Kindle edition. Denise, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Main Street's Ashley Thornburg. You can read Denise's blog at rawfoodsos.com. Well, we're going to have our weekly chat with Dave Thompson after the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. 2013 was another record year for air passenger boardings in North Dakota. The State Aeronautics Commission says 1.1 million passengers took commercial airline flights in North Dakota. That's a 10% increase from 2012, where North Dakota topped the million passenger mark for the first time. Kyle Warner is the interim director of the Aeronautics Commission.
If you think about it, back in 2008, when we did a forecast of when we would reach a million passengers, the forecast at that time was that we would be reaching that mark somewhere in the year 2035. And with all of the growth we've seen with the oil industry and just the economic growth our state has been seeing, we were able to reach the million passenger mark in 2012, which is pretty remarkable.
Wanner says 5 of the 8 commercial airports in North Dakota set records in 2013. He says Williston led the way with a 150% increase in 2013 compared with 2012. Great River Energy has some new figures concerning its economic impact in North Dakota.
We provide more than $1.2 billion in economic activity, over $57 million in state and local taxes, and then have an impact of direct and indirect jobs of about 1,940 jobs. So a tremendous impact, and that's through our power plants that are located at Coal Creek Station, Stanton Station, and then Spiritwood Station near Jamestown, North Dakota.
That's Great River spokesman Lyndon Anderson. Power produced by the plants goes to customers in Minnesota. And a new power plant near Spiritwood, east of Jamestown, should be online later this year. The 99-megawatt Spiritwood Station was built by Great River Energy. Again, Lyndon Anderson.
It will be commercially online on November 1st. We will operate it prior to then, but it will be in commercial operation on November 1st of this year.
The lignite-fired power plant will provide steam to the existing Cargill malt plant nearby. Great River Energy says that makes Spiritwood Station the first of its kind in the state. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and it is time to talk with Dave Thompson, Prairie Public's news director. Every week at Friday, we chat with him about the headlines and what's developing out there. Dave, thanks for joining us.
You are very welcome, Doug.
I guess the weather's on people's minds these days.
Boy, this has been an interesting week. So you have clipper after clipper after clipper. It looks like we get a clipper for a day or two. Then we get nice for a day or two, then another clipper for a day or two. And the last clipper that went through was kind of a severe one. And as a matter of fact, it got some national attention. The Weather Channel, of course, set up in Fargo during this whole thing, and there was some very, very strong winds. As a matter of fact, Doug, the strongest wind that I saw was a gust of 76 miles per hour.
Wow.
At Garrison.
Almost a hurricane.
It is. Well, a hurricane is sustained winds of 74 miles per hour, so 76 is definitely hurricane force.
Wow. And we've got a little bit coming yet.
Yeah, this one's going to be kind of strong, 30 to 40 miles per hour winds, but we're not talking about the 60 to 70 mile per hour winds and not talking about that really Arctic cold that came through, but it's another clipper coming through.
Well, I noticed in my last heating bill that the month, they always compare it. Mm-hmm. Last year, the same month, this year, this month was 11 degrees colder during rate period. So it's hitting the pocketbooks and the heating bills,
that's
for sure.
True, it will.
In the meantime, even though it's cold, cold, cold out there, we do have some record oil production and gas production, and maybe the cold will mitigate. I don't know.
It's kind of interesting that the figures that are presented lag behind a couple of months. Now, in November, we set a record. We're getting close to that million barrel a day mark. But the director of the Mineral Resources Division, Lynn Helms, is predicting perhaps it might be slower in December and January. Reason being, cold months and frac fluid is hard to keep warm.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of companies, he said, went away from the idea of trucking in frac fluid to using the abundant, surface moisture and groundwater that was in the oil patch, and we're using some of that. Well, that's frozen over too. So he's saying you might see flat months for maybe December and January just because of the cold weather.
Well, then it's probably going to bounce up just as soon as it warms up.
There was another thing that you mentioned about natural gas. Well, natural gas is up, but the amount of flaring is up too, and there's a reason for that. Because the Tioga gas plant, which is owned by Hess, went offline as they were getting ready to, get the expansion online. But there were a couple of weather-related delays on that. It looks like that's not coming back until February 1st. So we spiked back up to 30% flaring, and he said might spike up a little bit more. But after the gas plant comes online, then that should start going down again.
Well, you mentioned Lynn Helms. You and Danielle worked on a story this week about the Democratic NPL leadership wants to separate his duties, the promotion of the oil and gas industry duty, from the regulation of it.
Right, and that was something that Governor Dalrymple had actually suggested for the 2011 legislative session, to create a desk in the Department of Commerce that would be just simply to promote energy. And then the Mineral Resources Department would be solely on regulation. Lynn Helms was asked about that at a press conference, that the Democrats had brought that back up. And he said at the press conference that first and foremost, he is a regulator, and he pointed to the new rules that he says are probably some of the toughest rules in the nation as evidence that he is and his department are concerned about keeping the environment safe, keeping it as safe as possible. But then you had, of course, the rail line thing, and you know that's not necessarily the Department of Mineral Resources' fault because rail is regulated by federal authorities. So, you know, you've got an interesting discussion that's going on. And even the governor had to weigh in a little bit. He said, you know, first and foremost, Lynn Helms is a regulator, but he is enthusiastic about the industry, and he's often asked to speak and to make predictions, and some people may consider that to be promotional. Well, that's going to be the beauty is the eye of the beholder.
Okay, well, it might come up, though, in the next legislative session.
It might come up in the next session. I don't doubt that maybe Senate Majority Leader Max Schneider or House Majority Leader Kenton Onstad are going to have legislation drafted.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the rail incident, and the governor has been talking about the tank cars and the railroads and, you know, what's in the tank cars. He is, of course, a native of Castleton, and just outside of Castleton is where this started. I heard an interview with him where he actually laid out the number of trains that are going, and it is 360 trains a month, roughly, going mm-hmm. east or west.
And that's not going to slow down anytime soon. And the reason being is if you can train it, if you can put it on a rail car and ship the crude oil somewhere other than if you need to send it via pipeline to Cushing, Oklahoma, you can get a better price because sometimes it's discounted because of the kind of crude it is. It's light, sweet crude, which takes a different refining process than the heavier, sludgy crude that we're kind of used to seeing. So it's a different type of crude. It takes a different type of process. And basically, shippers are saying, okay, we're going to send it where it's going to get the best price. There still is a prediction that maybe up to 90% of oil is going to be leaving the state via rail. However, you hear in the background that pipeline companies are taking another look saying, gee, we may have to move to get some more options, some more pipeline options to get that crude out of North Dakota. Now, one of the things that's talked about is the Sandpiper pipeline, which goes northern route roughly along US 2 and would go to Duluth, Minnesota, and then ship from there. That's one potential. So there are some potentials that are out there that it's going to take a while to get all these things sited, but for the time being, it's going to be railed.
In the meantime, Canada is telling the US to make a decision on the Keystone XL.
And that's really interesting because, you know, Canada's interest and a lot of refiners' interest is to get that Canadian sands oil. We used to call it tar sands or oil sands, whatever you want to call it, to get that oil to market. An on-ramp, which would be built near Baker, Montana, could take up to as much as 150,000 barrels of Bakken crude per day.
Basically to thin the oil sands, right?
It would thin the oil sands pretty much. And 150,000 barrels a day is a good chunk of oil, but you're talking about 1 million barrels being shipped out of North Dakota.
And
so, you can hear the arguments on both sides of the Keystone XL pipeline.
And, of course, the rail shipment they're using now, there's a rail car that is highly controversial, the DOT 111. Mm-hmm. When we last spoke about this last week, I was under the impression that about a third of the tank cars out there were these newer versions. Well, it's a fraction of that. It's not, and there are like 350,000 tank cars out there. Only a fraction of those are the newer ones, the double-hulled ones with end protection on them. The other ones are these DOT 111s, which were involved in the accident outside of Castleton.
Right, and that's what the governor is pushing for and the state's congressional delegation. They're pushing for the railroad regulators at the federal level to come up with some new standards to get these cars, you know, the 111s kind of off the track, if you can, and go to these, double-hulled cars with more protections. Well, came this week, there was an announcement by the Federal Railroad Administration, I think is the agency, saying that these regulations probably won't go into effect for another year, and that has the congressional delegation a little bit upset, saying, hey, look, we've got to prevent these things from happening. If we're going to keep shipping oil by rail, and there doesn't seem to be any appetite to stop it at this point, you need to have the rails safer. So they're pushing to get the regulations in place sooner rather than later.
Well, I would think there'd be lots of communities along those rail lines that are anxious for this to get resolved as well.
If I remember correctly, I believe there is a meeting pending with the railroad regulator.
It's tomorrow in Fargo.
That's right. That's coming up tomorrow in Fargo, the congressional delegation, the governor, and they're going to meet with some people from the city of Castleton, which is the closest to what happened there. And if you think, if that rail car was just maybe a half mile further east, what we could be talking about today.
Okay. Well, we've got another giant utility in the state, and that's Basin Electric. They've had a little turmoil there.
Oh, yeah, they've had a little turmoil. The CEO resigned basically immediately, and I haven't been able to nail down all the details on this yet, but apparently there was a board meeting, and he resigned right there, and he left. Now they have an interim CEO, and they're going to be starting a nationwide search. What you're hearing about the CEO, Andrew Seri, well, he'd been around for a couple of years. There were some people inside Basin who were telling us that he wasn't a good fit because he came from the investor-owned utility side, a bit different from a co-op and a bit different from a generation and transmission co-op. And they sometimes didn't quite mesh. So apparently there was some tug and pull among the co-op members with him. And basically nothing personally against the man. I've had a chance to interview him on a couple of occasions, found him very delightful and very willing to talk. But apparently it was just a vision, shall we say, a vision conflict about where they should go.
Well, there's a very big project that involves Basin Electric that's running into some issues, and that's the transmission line siding.
345 kilovolt transmission line to go to northwestern North Dakota to help serve the oil patch. Right now, there is a shortage of electricity in the oil patch area, and Basin is one of the companies that wants to provide some electricity to the co-ops in that oil patch. The only trouble is that the line that they want to build will go through a historic site, the Kildare Mountain Battlefield site, and that's where the tug and pull is going on. There was a meeting this week, and they apparently looking at some alternative routes, maybe three different alternatives for it. But still, it's going to be in the viewshed of the battlefield site, so a lot of people are not happy about that.
Well, that's a very important battlefield site for Native Americans in the state.
It is.
So, interesting to see how that actually
shakes
out.
I think this is one you're going to have to follow very closely. We will be following it very closely.
Now, you're working on a story, right, about the Public Service Commission and new Environmental Protection Agency regulations?
Right. Next week, Wednesday, the Public Service Commission's having an open forum with the Environmental Protection Agency on the federal level. The EPA regional administrator is coming up from Denver, and they're going to ask some questions about what is the proposal in terms of emission of CO2, emission of nitrous oxide, sulfur dioxide. Apparently there's a lot of questions being raised about how does it affect new plants, how does it affect existing power plants, what's going to be the effect on the North Dakota power plants? And are they able to do it without spending an awful lot of money on an unproven technology? That's the argument that the Public Service Commission is making on behalf of some of the coal companies. They have questions, and I asked them specifically, you're not holding this meeting to kind of beat up on EPA. They said, no, what we want is more information. It's kind of a fact-finding mission. So we'll see what happens.
Well, let's talk water. The State Water Commission is ready to award a contract to work on a plan to bring Missouri River to the river water to the Red River Valley. That's been talked about for a long time.
It has been talked about. Now what they're going to do is award a contract for a consultant to help draft the plan and how you're going to get the water from Lake Sakakawea to the Red River, and where does it go? Flow into the Red River? Does it go into the Cheyenne? Does it go into the Red? Does it cross the Cheyenne? There's a lot of questions to be answered on that, too. But, of course, the reason they're doing this is that because currently the water situation in the Red, although it's had some very momentous floods, you know, that happens only part of the year. And part of the year, there seems to be kind of a water shortage if you're going to have more industrial development in the valley.
Well, I've been here when the Red virtually stopped.
Yes.
And back in the 30s, it did that too. So
in the 30s, I guess there was, you could actually walk across the Red between Fargo and Moorhead.
Yeah. So another water source is something that people are interested in, I think.
And when you're talking about 98% of the surface water in North Dakota is in the Missouri River system, well, that's a logical place to get it.
Airlines are booming in the state.
Yeah, we just heard that not too long ago in Danielle's newscast. 1.1 million riders. Now, last year, it hit the 1 million mark for the first time. I was talking to the Aeronautics Commission director, and he said a study that was done in the early 2000s before the Bakken boom said we'll probably hit 1 million passenger in the year 2024 or 2035. So you're talking about a huge influx of airline passengers, and you can basically say thanks to the Bakken boom.
And you said Williston has had a big jump because they have jet service now.
Right. They finally this year got a regional jet to Denver and a regional jet to Minneapolis. And you have a situation where Williston's looking at a new airport because they've run out of room. Minot is going to be building a new airport because Minot's run out of room. So, you know, there are apparently some other airlines that want to come serve North Dakota, but can't because there's no room.
You're also working on a story, Dave, that we've talked about before, but intellectual property. And
hearing
you've got
next week.
An important committee discussion coming up.
Right. On Wednesday, the Interim Higher Education Committee and the Interim Judiciary Committee will be holding a hearing at NDSU about intellectual property. And what we're talking about is if a student comes up with a discovery while the student is working on campus using university equipment, maybe working for one of the companies that contracts, who owns that intellectual property? Is it the university? Is it the student? Is it the company? Or is it some combination of all? And it really has become a fairly big issue nationwide. So
yeah,
the state's going to get into it, too.
That could get real sticky.
Oh, yes, it could.
And meanwhile, Craig Cobb and Kynan Dutton are still awaiting trial.
Right, and I don't know when that trial is going to be set, but and they're still in jail because Cobb is being held under $1 million bond. Dutton is $50,000 bond.
And these are the two white supremacists who were arrested
from Leith,
North
exactly.
Dakota. All right. Well, Dave, always a pleasure to chat with you.
Good to chat with you.
Dave Thompson is Prairie Public's news director. We go to the movies with Matt Olean and talk Oscars as well in a moment.
Orfeo is a novel that takes its hero from musical composer to bioterror fugitive, all for the love of creation.
But this balancing act between wanting to make it new and wanting to make it loved and beautiful is familiar to me.
Author Richard Powers on his new novel and the struggle to create. Today on All Things Considered from NPR News.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and Matt Olean is in studio because it's time to find out what he thinks about the Oscar nominations. Big news this week out of Hollywood.
What a great year, Doug. This is, I think 2013 is going to go down as one of the top deep years of the last 15 or 20 years. We have 9 Best Picture nominees, kind of the ones I thought. I think it's a 3-way battle to win the award between American Hustle, 12 Years a Slave, and Gravity. It's going to be one of those three. I can't quite get a sense which one it is at this point, but that may break in the next month or so. A couple of interesting shockers. Tom Hanks not nominated for Captain Phillips. That was his best performance in years. But that Best Actor category, Doug, is so deep. I felt Redford was in trouble. He would not get nominated, and that the momentum was trending toward Leo DiCaprio, and I was right.
So the older veterans got shut out.
The older veterans got shut out, except for Bruce Dern.
Ah,
he's in.
The oldest veteran.
But I did not see Christian Bale edging out Hanks. That was a bit of a surprise, but clearly what that tells me, Doug, is the American Hustle momentum is real, it is strong, and it could drive them all the way to Best Picture. The other shocker was in Best Actress. Emma Thompson was thought to be a lock for Saving Mr. Banks. She did not get in. Meryl Streep got her 950th nomination. I'm joking. It was her 18th. I've not seen August Osage County, so I can't comment. I will see it. I don't want to overstate what my feelings on that are, but I'll have to see that and then get back to you on that. But Thompson was thought to get in, and Streep was thought to maybe not get in. And I was really happy that Sally Hawkins got nominated for Blue Jasmine in Supporting Actress. There was kind of a thought that maybe Oprah would get nominated for The Butler, but Sally Hawkins' work is superior, and I think that was the right choice.
Well, any other surprises besides those acting things?
Well, the director category was really going to be tight. I felt that David Russell, Steve McQueen, and Alfonso Cuarón were locks. They were. And then there were four people vying for two spots: Marty Scorsese, Paul Greengrass for Captain Phillips, Spike Jonze for Her, and Alexander Payne for Nebraska. I predicted on Facebook the day before the nominations that I felt Scorsese and Payne would get in, and they did. But I have to believe it was very close that Jonze and Greengrass were very close. Spike Jonze did get some other nominations from Her. He got a screenplay and a Best Song nomination, so he did fine.
And two very different movies got 10 nominations.
Yeah, American Hustle with 10 and Gravity with 10 and 12 Years a Slave with 9. And for those reasons, Doug, I think those are the three favorites because they had the most nominations. I think 12 Years a Slave is the best film of the year, but I could see the Academy going Hustle or Gravity also.
Well, I noticed that the movie we're going to talk about now, Inside Llewyn Davis, opened after the New Year. So it's eligible for the next round of Oscars.
No, it's eligible.
But it didn't get in?
It got cinematography and sound.
Okay.
They had two nominations. But I think the Coen fans and the people who like this movie like I do were hoping for maybe a Best Song nomination for the little novelty Please Mr. Kennedy that's in the film. And honestly, I thought the Coens would get a script nomination, too. They've racked up a lot of those over the years. So, it did get a couple nominations. The cinematography is terrific. I like this film a lot, Doug. It's one of my favorites of the year. It's one of my favorite Coen films ever. Oscar Isaac, who's terrific as Llewyn Davis, and in a less crowded year, he could have gotten the Best Actor mix. He plays this early 60s folk singer in New York. This is kind of the pre-Dylan Greenwich Village scene out there, and he's trying to make it. He's coping with the suicide of his former music partner, so he's now going solo. But he's a guy that can't quite catch a break. Justin Timberlake, who plays another folk singer, is trying to give him some session work and a break here and there. But he, at every turn, he just doesn't quite make the right decision. For example, Doug, in the film, he plays session musician on this song called Please Mr. Kennedy. And he needs the money so bad that he takes the paycheck and doesn't take the royalty check that could be coming later. And, of course, it becomes a hit. He is offered a chance by a manager that wants to form a two-man, one-girl singing folk group. He doesn't want to do it because he wants to be solo.
Oh, no.
Oops. Could have been Peter, Paul, and Mary. So that's what the film's about. And it really cast a hypnotic spell over me. The cinematography is terrific. The music is terrific. Oscar Isaac really delivers some haunting versions of folk ballads like The Death of Queen Jane and a couple others that he sings. There's a great rendition of 500 Miles in the film by Carey Mulligan and Justin Timberlake. Carey Mulligan plays the ex-girlfriend of Llewyn Davis in the film, and she hates him now at this point. So I like this film a lot. This is pure Coen. You know, they adapted No Country for Old Men from other material. They adapted True Grit from other material. Now they're back to pure Coen stuff. John Goodman shows up, of course, because it's a Coen film, as kind of a weird guy that Llewyn gets a ride to Chicago to try to do some gigging there, and it's a disastrous trip. It's got all the Coen elements. Like this film a lot. Clearly, the Academy didn't like it as well as some of us have liked it that have seen it around here. I know Greg Carlson really liked it as well, who writes film reviews for the High Plains Reader, and he's on the film festival committee with me. But I think people will like this. If you like 60s folk music, you're really going to like the soundtrack. And Oscar Isaac is really terrific in the lead role.
All right. So you are very positive about Inside Llewyn Davis. And when are the Oscars?
March 2nd.
Okay.
Well. And next week we'll talk about Her, the Spike Jonze film. I just saw that, so we can review that next week.
Very good. Okay. Matt Olien, we've been to the movies. Decoded 8 Book is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is another Countdown to Statehood edition of Dakota Datebook for January 17th. The territorial legislature met on Tuesday, January 8, 1889, for the beginning of what was hopefully the last session as a territory.
On the first day, the Republicans in the House called a caucus to select their leaders and map out their strategy, while their Democratic counterparts decided against it. Edwin McNeil from Cass County concluded it involved too much time and paperwork since he was the sole Democrat in the House. On the other side of the hall, of the 25 members of the council, only three were Democrats. Although both houses had a heavy Republican majority, it should be noted that there was a strong representation by the Farmers Alliance, which aligned with the Democrats on some issues. The Farmers Alliance planned to introduce legislation to eliminate or reduce the control of the grain buyers, millers, and railroads, and had effectively campaigned to send a significant number of representatives to the legislature. Among them was Smith Stimmel, the president of the Senate. On the second day of the session, the two houses met in joint session as Governor Lewis K. Church delivered a 1 hour and 30-minute message. Church, appointed by a Democratic president, was a friend of James J. Hill. Church was unpopular in Dakota Territory and was referred to as a carpetbagger who had, under the spoils system, replaced all the official territorial positions long held by faithful Republicans with Democrats. This did not sit well with the Republican-dominated population, and most people resented the power wielded by Democrats. Using veto power and special appointments, Church protected Eastern and railroad interests and opposed the Farmers Alliance. His administration had also been involved in some shady dealings relating to the construction of the asylum at Yankton, which, due to poor materials and cost-cutting, resulted in several deaths when the walls collapsed. This was Church's last session, and he was sure to be recalled when Harrison assumed the presidency. That evening, after the governor's message, it was time to hear from Dennis Hanifin, a character called the territory's squatter governor. A reporter for the Bismarck Tribune stated that Hanifin was there to cheer his constituents on their way to a conflict with the world and a reversal of all customs, styles, practices, and beliefs. In commenting on the politicians descending upon Bismarck, Hanifin stated that they needed to purify the political atmosphere with 500 funerals, 50 at Yankton, 50 in the Red River Valley, 51 on the Missouri Slope, and 349 in Fargo. It was the start of an interesting session. Today's Dakota Datebook is written by Jim Davis. I'm Earl Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
Monday on Main Street, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day, and we'll visit with Camilla Wilson, who was in Memphis, Tennessee the day King was killed, April 4th, 1968, and who wrote about the civil rights movement. We'll talk in detail about her experiences growing up in the Deep South and how she got involved with the civil rights movement. We'll also hear about Tanks of Thanks, a program from Cenex that seeks to honor those who go above and beyond to serve in their communities. And you'll hear about that. And Tom Ezern will have this week's Plainsfolk column about St. Patrick of South Dakota. So we hope you can join us on Monday for Main Street. In the meantime, we hope the Clipper doesn't clip you. Stay warm and have a great weekend.